Today's date is November 30th, 2009. We're at the Amelia Island Museum of History. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Albert Joseph Glover, date of birth September 20th, 1941, place of birth Paterson, New Jersey. My name is Robert Hamer, and I will interview Mr. Glover on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Frank Reidinger, who will operate the recording equipment. During the course of the interview, we'll be discussing the following subjects. What was your period of service? During which conflicts did you serve? What was your rank? And where did you serve? But first, let's start, Al, by you telling us, what was your motivation for enlisting in the Navy in March 1959?
Well, it was a mutual agreement between my father and I. He thought it was about time I grew up and convinced me that I had to go into the military. He was kind enough to let me select what branch I wanted to go into, and I selected the Navy. I had just completed high school. I went to a trade school, and I took a four-year course in carpentry, so I wanted to get into the Seabees, and that's what motivated me to go, and I took the test, and I got out of high school in January of 1959, mm-hmm. the middle or end of January 1959, and I was in Great Lakes, Illinois, March 29th. So it wasn't too long from the time I graduated high school.
When you enlisted, did they commit to you that you'd be able to go into the Seabees?
Actually, they said that I could get into the Seabees, that it wouldn't be a problem. Which turned out that that wasn't true. Mm-hmm. You had to take an exam, a mechanical ability exam, mm-hmm. When you were in basic training, which I didn't do too good at. And so when they were trying to place everyone mm-hmm. in the company throughout that was graduating from basic training, they decided that they would let me go into the Seabees. It was only myself and one other person mm-hmm. in the whole brigade wow. that they sent to the Seabees.
Yeah. So it's a pretty specialized field.
Well, yeah, it was kind of unique in those days. I mean, it was all construction. Mm-hmm. The other gentleman that went into the Seabees, he was what they called a utility man, mm-hmm. which we would call a plumber.
Okay.
And I was called a builder.
Okay.
Builder light, mm-hmm. Which was anything from concrete to painting to construction.
Sure. Where did you go for your advanced training?
My advanced training, I went to engineering school in Port Hueneme, California.
Okay.
My basic training, I went to Great Lakes, Illinois.
Great.
I spent 20 or so weeks in Port Hueneme mm-hmm. at the school. And after that, I got assigned to a mobile construction battalion, which they called MCB.
Gotcha.
The people that were actually in these battalions, they called them Mob 10, Mob 5, Mob 7.
Right.
And they had, I think, five or six battalions stationed on the West Coast, and five or six battalions stationed on the East Coast.
Oh, yeah.
So I wound up on the West Coast.
Yeah, yeah. Now, 22 weeks is a long time. What were the kinds of things they trained you on there?
It was pretty sophisticated, thinking back. They would teach you how to, like if you were in framing, they taught you how to figure out how to lay out rafters, the wall types of layout. Mm-hmm. They taught you how to mix concrete, you know, what the ratios are.
Sure.
You know, today when we want concrete, we just call up and they come in a truck. Well, we mixed it all by hand.
Sure.
And they taught us rigging, you know, because, you know, we would be dropped on some island someplace and have to build
sure.
everything.
What about explosives and things? Would they train you to be infantry type ready if you had combat?
Well, when I first went in and we were purely construction, mm-hmm. And then about halfway through my my time there, they decided that they were going to train us in advanced infantry training, jungle warfare.
Right.
And we went from not half the shave or, you know, we were kind of like, you know, we went to morning quarters in, mm-hmm. In shorts, no shirts,
right.
You know, to we got attached to the 3rd Marine Division.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got attached to the Marines, what we had to do then was we had to wear starch green, spit shine boots, yeah. And all that. So I was in a heavy weapons platoon. I was a machine gunner.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
50 caliber type thing?
Yes,
yeah.
50 caliber.
Okay. Did they train you how to do anything like build a bridge or do a heliport kind of thing? Was that part of it as well?
Yes. We did pontoon bridges, regular bridges. We laid down airstrips.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did the concrete, the airstrips. They taught you to do the model in the CBs is can do. So mm-hmm. You'd never say you can't do something.
Sure.
You know, and what they would do is if you were, like I was, a builder, and I remember one time a chief came and said, move that equipment. Well, I wasn't an equipment operator.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, I can't. I don't know how to do that. And he said, you know the model of the CBs. Get up on that thing and move it.
Sure.
Well, I did, but I put it in the wrong place. Put it back in the water. We were on an island in the South Pacific by the equator at the time. But you learn how to do a lot of things.
Sure.
And we put up bridges. We would go to an island. There'd be nothing there. And so we'd have to do our own water purification,
mm-hmm.
Build the tent cities that we would live in.
Yeah.
And then we would start on our projects. Often they would drop our equipment.
Mm-hmm.
By plane, or if they couldn't get there, by ship. And and we would get the equipment, and we'd have to maintain the equipment. And often we were in huge projects where when they would rotate the battalion out, we would be overseas for 10 months, in the U.S. for 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way our deployments were. And so I was kind of fortunate because I was back in December and January.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd get your 30 days leave. I'd get most of the time Christmas and New Year's at home,
wow.
Which was good.
Yeah.
And then they would leave all the equipment on these islands and on these bases, and they'd rotate another battalion over there, and they'd continue to work.
Sure.
Because these projects were for a long time.
And they were practical projects. I mean, what you were doing was going
to
be
yeah.
They were
yeah.
permanent in nature and things
yeah.
like that.
For example, first time I deployed, I went out to Guam in the Mariana Islands. And there was two projects there. They had a naval air station, which was on Nimitz Hill. It's named after the Admiral Nimitz. And what they were doing there is they were building housing for there was going to be a big push over there.
Mm-hmm.
So they were building housing for not only the military but the dependents.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was working on Naval Station Guam. And what we were doing is they were building plants and warehousing where we could store the U.S. could store atomic weapons and stuff like that.
Mm.
And basically what we did is we built these and then most of them underground.
Mm-hmm.
And then what would happen is if you flew over it, it looked like a golf course. You know, they had all the bunkers and stuff
sure.
like that. And it was kind of interesting because when we were there, we were, you know, we'd be blasting and stuff like that. And we'd come up in these Japanese caves
yeah.
that were from the Second World War.
Sure.
And some of them were big as hospitals.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they had hospitals there and the bunks would still be there. And it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And then the second place I deployed to was they took a detachment from the battalion that when we were in Guam, and they sent 85 of us to an island called Canton Island, which was in the Phoenix Islands. It's 2 degrees below the equator. It's 112 in the shade.
Yeah, can't imagine.
Yeah, and it was the island was shaped like a donut.
Yeah.
and it was 9 miles long.
Yeah.
And inside was a like a lagoon, and it had a an entryway where you can get into the, you know, it was pretty big, though. I mean, and you could stand on the shortest part of the island, and you could stand in the lagoon and get the spray of the ocean. It was only about 20 yards wide.
Wow.
And then there was a station there for Qantas Airlines, an Australian Airlines. And they had a what they called a hotel. There were 6 beds for people that wanted to stay overnight. In those days, you know, the jets, we didn't have many jets.
Right.
So, and that was run by Fijian natives.
Okay.
And we become very good friends with them.
Good.
From there, I, of course, we go back to the U.S. And from there, being 112 degrees in the shade, I went to Adak, Alaska, for 10 months,
yeah.
Navy's wisdom. And there, spent 10 months there. I went to Kodiak for a 30-day thing, Kodiak, Alaska.
What kind of activities did you do there?
In Kodiak or Adak?
Both.
Both,
yeah.
Yeah. In Adak, Alaska, I was on a concrete crew. And when I first got there, and then we were building these concrete, I don't know what you would call them, that would house sort of like irrigation runoff type things. Oh. Because it's, you know, it's cold and it's windy and there's a lot of snow, you know.
Sure.
And when we were there, almost everything, you went from one place to another underground because, you know, it was so cold. Mm-hmm. you couldn't go out. In some of the areas there. We also were putting in and restoring piers. So we were doing the pile driving.
Wow.
And then it's kind of interesting because they'd put you on a little raft and you'd wear these like rubber suits.
Yeah.
And of course you get 2 or 3 guys on these rafts, and it'd be 4 or 5 rafts. And what you were doing was putting up the timbers, making the thing and bolting them in, you know, so you could. And they would only leave you there for 20 minutes at a time because it was so cold.
I was gonna say, yeah.
And we had instructions if somebody fell in, you had to get them out of there because they only had like maybe 8 or 9 minutes.
Right. Hypothermia.
Before they, and that's how cold it was. And the wind was just unbelievable there.
Wow.
What a godforsaken place that was.
That was not a good assignment.
Yeah, yeah, we were there for 10 months. Of course, we saw, the whole time we were there, we never saw any women.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was some of the assignments I had there. And our recreation is we went to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And there really wasn't much to do. You know, I mean, it wasn't.
What about food and mail and things like that?
Well, it was kind of interesting. We'd get a mail call once a month.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, the way we got our mail was Allegheny Airlines would fly in, and a commercial airline. And then we'd get the word when they were coming.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone, I mean, it sounds kind of foolish, but everyone would get on anything that moved. And they'd go out to the airport with binoculars because when the stewardess opened the door to pitch out the mail, that was the only time you saw a woman. And everybody'd be cheering and all. You know, it was kind of foolish, but it was one of the things that happened up there in Adak.
So you'd get a bunch of mail at one time once a month.
Yeah.
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 Gosh.
Once a month. And, of course, you had, you know, you could make phone calls, but, you know, it's not like today where you got...
Sure.
Unlimited long distance and stuff. You know, you make a phone call, and my parents were back in Paterson, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And you make a phone call and collect or something like that. I mean, it was very expensive.
What about food and sleeping quarters and things like that? How
they had concrete barracks.
Mm-hmm.
Lived in dormitories with, you know, up and down bunks.
Gotcha.
Depending on what grade you were. First class and above had maybe 15 people in a dormitory.
Mm-hmm.
We had about 35. And then the Chiefs had like 5 or 6 or 7, you know. Of course, we never got to see the officers' quarters where they were living.
So, what was your rank at this time?
I was a construction man. They had what, in the Navy, if you go through a school or some specialized training like I did, they call you a striker. So I was a construction man, which was three stripes, and ours were blue. CBs were that designated that you were CBs. Yeah. And then above that, I had a little, we had our insignia for Builder Light. It was a plumb bob with a square through it. So that would be on the top of there.
Sure.
And that's what I was when I was up in Alaska. And of course, we came home. While I was up there, I played basketball quite a bit.
Oh, okay. So they had things like that that you could do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Intramural, you know. And every place we were, I mean, we were always teamed up more with the Marines than we were with the fleet sailors.
Okay.
You know. And, of course, up in Adak, Alaska, the fleet sailors, they just wanted to come in and get rid of the troops and get out of there, you know.
How many soldiers or sailors did you have up there at one time? A couple thousand?
Oh, no, Adak was, that's a big base up there. Okay. It's a communication facility. It's only like 300 or 400 miles from Russia.
Oh, okay. All right.
So in those really days, it was really a big deal, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, a lot of naval station people, personnel up there were all in communications and things like that. And that's what we were doing up there. We were up there doing the construction, you know, like maintaining a city, you know, just doing all the construction part of it.
Sure.
So, and we left there, came back down and spent a couple of months. And from there we went to, Okinawa.
Okay.
I got a chance to play, when I was playing basketball out of that intramural league, they made like sort of an all-star team, and we traveled around and played a little basketball, which was great duty, you know. And so they had to do had to find some work for us to do. So we would do things like a, you know, a flag officer or something. We'd go in and remodel our office, put up paneling or something like that during the day, and you know, they didn't let you go out and play basketball most of the time. One of the things in the CBs before we got into the semi-military thing, you know, we worked from sun up to sundown.
Mm-hmm.
They were, that was our hours, no matter where we were. As long as light, we would be out there working. And one thing they'd allow us to do was, is you could go into the, and you really don't get this in the Navy, you could go into the mess hall in the morning, and if you wanted to order steak and eggs, you could order it and they'd give it to you. Because, you know, you were working so hard. That didn't last too long, though. And but this is just some of the things that are popping into my mind, you know.
How'd they work it in Alaska? It was pretty dark there, right?
Well, I remember we'd go out and our transportation from the barracks, and when we were working outside, our transportation from the barracks to the site was a dump truck.
Mm-hmm.
And our crew, we had to fit 6-7 people in that dump truck. So the guy who was driving it, he had to get out there early in the morning. And I seem to remember we would be going about 5:30 in the morning. And the guy had to get out there like a half hour early because he had to start it up because of the air brakes. They had to heat something up in there, otherwise the brakes wouldn't work. So, and of course, the other thing was, is everybody tried to get there early because you don't want to be stuck and not have any room and have to sit on somebody's lap or get in the back of that thing and act cold. So, but you know, you're young and,
resilient. Yeah. What you got to do.
Yeah. And you're more afraid of the chief or the first class and they holler at you, it makes you grow up.
Were there any concerns at all in 1959 to 62? What were the conflicts going on in the world that maybe you thought you might be part of? Did you ever think that you'd get assigned to it?
It was actually the beginning of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
I think the Vietnam War actually probably started in 58,
right.
59, but our involvement wasn't too much there. And I was able to, when I signed up in the Navy, I was 17. Mm-hmm. So they had a thing they called a minority cruise. If you went and signed up the day before your 18th birthday, up to that point, you got out the day before your 21st birthday. Mm-hmm. So if you could time it right, you could only, the Navy was a 4-year service. Mm-hmm. So if you timed it right, you could actually spend 3 years. So I spent about, 3 years, 8-9 months. Mm-hmm. So I was able to get out. We were in Okinawa, and they were starting to deploy from there to Thailand.
Yeah.
And then from Thailand, they were going out, and they were taking they'd drop them at a grid coordinates, and they'd take soil samples and stuff like that, planning for when we were going to go over there. Could we put airstrips down? Could we do this? Could we do that? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and you go over and you take soil samples and bring them back, and they just like they do here, soil mine it, see how, if it's going to withhold the weight. And you know, some of the airstrips we put down were big iron mats, mm-hmm. and they drop them down, they look like pallets, and you take them off and they hook together,
yeah.
and you pour like a, not concrete, but I guess like a crushed stone underneath them, sort of. Mm-hmm. And we could lay those down and take them up in 72 hours. Mm-hmm. So that they'd have the planes landed in 72 hours.
Sure.
I mean, it's incredible things that they do. And this is all, we didn't have too much machinery.
Right. We probably had the same kind of expectation if you had to make a bridge or something like
yes.
that.
Yes.
They wanted
yes.
you to do it in a certain amount of time.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Probably had you train during the day and then do it again at night kind
yeah.
of thing if you had
to. Yes. Yeah. And that's exactly the way they did it. We had a detachment that went to the Philippines on the island of Mindoro, and we were playing war games then.
Yeah.
And we were laying down airstrips there and taking them up. Of course, they said, you know, the Navy would always say the two officers would make bets, you know, I can get this done in
sure.
such and such a time. And so the personnel were told, if you can get this up in less than 72 hours, we're going to send you home. Okay.
Yeah.
So little do we know, we had ships that were scheduled to pick us up, and we got it done in less than 72 hours. And then we broke down the tent city and we all went out to the pier and stayed there for about 3 weeks. Just sitting there, leaning
yeah.
up against the equipment and stuff, you know.
You wondered how many times that worked.
That sort of thing, yeah. So there's some of the fond memories. Of course, you didn't like it when you were there, you know.
Sure.
And before we went to Okinawa, we went down to Camp Pendleton and went through the jungle warfare school. We were there for 30 or 60 days. Doing all of that training, and
so there was a sense that they might be getting you ready for a deployment to like Vietnam.
They knew
it. That was on the maps.
Sure. We were the last ones to find that out, but
Probably did that affect your decision to leave, or were you planning on just doing the 3 years?
No, I was just planning on doing the 3 years and getting out of there. Okay. Yeah, I didn't plan on staying in. I don't think it ever entered my mind to stay in for another 4 years or whatever.
Did you make any lifelong friends there? Anybody that you've stayed in contact with through all the years? Or?
No, it was kind of interesting. I had a friend of mine. We were born on the same day, went into the Navy on the same day, and we were supposed to get discharged around the same time. So in that time, when you got discharged on the West Coast, they sent you to Treasure Island up by San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you would muster out. You'd get your money. They'd tell you how to adapt to civilian life. And he got there and got out before I did. When I got out, I went down to Southern California by Port Hueneme there, a town called Oxnard.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living there looking for him. And I found out that he was down in Tijuana driving a cab in Tijuana, Mexico. Yeah, and he was Mexican, but blonde-haired and blue-eyed. Unbelievable, yeah. And but I lost track of all those guys. I didn't, I haven't made contact with any of them.
Yeah. As you went from each deployment to deployment, did anybody else go with you? Did you have buddies that went at the same time?
Oh, yeah. Well, once you're in the battalion, you're in that battalion. Yeah, on. And the battalions had like anywhere from 1,500 to 1,800 men in them. And when they moved you, if you were, I quickly learned to get on the advanced group both ways or the delayed group because you come back by plane. You know, otherwise, I mean, the first time we deployed, we were on the ship from Port Hueneme, California to Guam. It was like 48 days.
Yeah,
took us to get there. You know, well, they'd go and they'd stop in Hawaii and they'd stop on Wake Island and then they'd stop. And they got to refuel and all that stuff. And those ships were something. They had us, and they had a couple of thousand Marines on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of close living quarters. And
sure. What about from a leadership perspective? Was there anybody that you served with or fought that inspired you, that became like a role model, or maybe you patented your style after, anything like that?
There was, I guess if there was someone like that, it was one of the chiefs we had when we were on Canton Island.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he took the time to teach us a lot of things, you know.
Yeah.
You know, simple nature comfort things. I mean, you know, we had to turn the salt water into fresh water.
Sure.
So that became very important,
right.
You know. We and like the steel workers made a tank, like we would have a water tank here.
Mm-hmm.
They made it on the ocean, and then that's where they get the water from. Then they would pipe it in, and actually, your showers were like a bucket with holes in them in the top, and you'd pull the lever, and that's where the water came out. And we built plywood sides and put screening in it and then dropped the tents over the top of it, and we lived four to a tent.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he took care of us. He taught us a lot of things.
Yeah. You know how to get it done.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Were your officers engineers? Or especially in CB activities?
Well, I'm not really sure about that. We had our battalion commander was a commander. I don't know what his background was. You know, I didn't. We never got up on that level to even talk to him unless you wound up in captain's mess or something like that. You know, and that'd be the only time you'd actually talk to him, or they'd have an inspection. He may say something to you. You know, they had a thing which they would call a pass and review. And I do remember one time we were back in the States, and an admiral came, and they made us get all on the parade grounds and dress blues and stuff. And we had a cook that was in our battalion, a little bitty guy. And he came out dressed with all his ribbons and medals on, and the admiral just, I mean, this guy had campaign ribbons from every place. And of course, he was in like 25, 26 years. And the captain, I mean, the admiral said to him, and I was really impressed with this. He said to him, you come with me, and the troops are going to, you're going to pass the review instead of the admiral.
Oh, wow.
So he had this, and he was a first classman cook, and he let him do the inspection of the whole battalion.
That's pretty cool, huh?
That was really neat.
Yeah.
And so I got discharged there in Okinawa. And
yeah, so I'll do that. Hal, before we go forward, is there anything you want to go back to, thinking about your career in the Navy?
Yeah, one of the things that I was truly impressed with was attached to the Seabees was a unit called the UDTs, which was the underwater demolition teams.
Okay.
These guys are divers, swimmers. They would go from the divers, you know, with the ball around their head to, and they were all explosive experts.
Mm-hmm.
And they evolved into today what we know as the Navy SEALs.
Sure.
But they were attached to the Seabees then, to our battalions. But they got all this specialized training.
Mm-hmm.
They would go away, and, you know, when we'd be home on leave, they'd be in San Diego or someplace training. And I mentioned before, when we were down at Camp Pendleton doing that advanced infantry training, they were with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to do these 5 to 7 mile forced marches.
Yeah.
You know, full pack, and, you know, you'd run in and walk in, and they're sure. double timing all this. And you would take a break, and, you know, you think you're going to die, you know, because it's pretty physical.
Sure.
And when we would stop for a break, they would get information and do one-hand push-ups after doing all this running. And, you know, we really didn't realize, you know, what they were actually doing, and we thought they were kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And then every place that they went, on the base in Camp Pendleton, they would double time, and they would go, like, say you're going to the chow hall, mm-hmm. to the mess hall, and they had a lifeboat, that each one of the teams had a lifeboat.
Wow.
And they would run with their arms extended straight up in the air, holding this lifeboat up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their training. In the morning, they'd get up, they'd take them out 2 or 3 miles in the ocean, drop them off, they'd swim back in.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were incredible.
Now, could you opt to maybe be considered for such a group like that?
Well, I don't think I could have. I mean, I don't think.
In the Navy at the time, if you were a CB and you wanted to become one of these specialists, could you tell your commanding officer or your chief?
Well, I don't know, because once I saw what they were doing,
yeah.
I had no desire to be in there. So,
yeah.
And I learned quickly in the service, if you ask questions about something, you may wind up there. But to tell you the truth, I'm not sure I could have actually completed that training. These were all big
sure.
guys, and I was just a little guy there. But they were just incredible shape.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were just in incredible shape. Yeah. And we didn't see them every day.
Yeah.
You know, you'd only see them when you went through some specialized training, and you would know because they'd have the patch.
Yeah.
You know, MCB-10,
right.
MCB-5. And then they'd have, where I told you the striker thing before, they'd have a UDT patch, and then you knew who they were.
Yeah.
If they had their uniforms on.
Sure.
But if we had our fatigues, our greens on, we had no insignias at all.
You couldn't tell. Yeah.
Couldn't tell who. Yeah. You know, the officers were the only ones you could tell, because they'd have their, you know, their bars on or whatever.
Exactly. So you processed out of Okinawa, was your last duty station?
Yes.
And you came back home to where? For the process of the final?
Yeah, I went to Treasure Island. The last, I told you before earlier in the interview that I played basketball.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing basketball in Okinawa, and I got hurt.
Oh.
And I tore the ligaments in my leg.
Hmm.
And I had my leg in a cast for 7 months.
Oh, wow.
So I couldn't do the construction. So they gave me this job with a pickup truck, and I took care of the library.
Oh.
So my job was to go to the other bases and trade books.
Oh, wow.
And I would work early in the morning. I'd have a couple hours there. Then when I get done, I'd go and try and trade the books, and then I'd have to open the library for lunchtime in mm-hmm. case anybody wanted to come in and read. And
what was this?
Okinawa. And then in the evening until 8 o'clock... But what it turned out was, it had all these tables and everything in there. They came in, they never read books. They came in and played cards. It was like all card games going on and the thing. So I did this for about 5 months.
Yeah.
But I had a truck, which was like huge
yeah.
in those days too.
Sure.
And I could go off the base and go to Kadena Air Force Base. I could go to the other places. And everybody was volunteering to be my helper.
Yeah, sure.
You know, because they wanted to get off the base. And you know, when you went off the base in all these places that we went, except ADAC, you couldn't wear your uniform when you went off the base. You had to put on civilian clothes.
Good point.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, you weren't allowed in town. Mm-hmm. The sailors that come from a ship, they will wear uniforms. We weren't allowed to.
Gotcha.
So we would go in civilian clothes. But then I got out in Okinawa and I went to Treasure Island, and I told you before I was looking for my friend. I stayed out in California for a while, got a job there. And then one day I was out there about 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
Working for an ex-chief.
Oh, really?
That was in our battalion. And he got out and started a construction company.
Perfect.
Laying cinder blocks. And because mm-hmm. out in California, most of the houses where we were cinder block and stuccoed, you know.
Right.
So we had worked for him and lived on the beach out there for a while. And then I came back to Patterson.
Patterson. What did you do in Patterson?
When I first got back, I went to work for a small construction company.
Mm-hmm.
I was making $1.25 an hour.
Wow.
Just to bring you back to the time frame.
Sure.
I worked for that guy for a while, and he missed a couple of paydays and stuff like that. So,
done.
Yeah. And the next job I had, I became a bartender.
Huh.
And my brother-in-law owned a bar and a restaurant, so I went in with him and worked there for 4 years.
Great.
And then the next job I had, I drove a tractor and trailer for a company that delivered exclusively to the A&P supermarkets.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I did that in New Jersey and New York City.
Sure.
New York State. And then I became a policeman.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. In New Jersey, a little sleepy town in New Jersey, Oakland, New Jersey. And I was there for 7 years. And then from there I left and went to the federal government and mm-hmm. became an agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Oh, no kidding.
Wow. Yeah. And I was there for, my total federal time was 26, 27 years.
Wow. Good for you. That's a good career. That's
yeah.
a big jump, different kind of background there.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when I was working on the trucks, that was a pretty laborious job. I mean, because you offloaded them,
yeah.
and you'd sometimes do 2 or 3 trailers a day.
Sure.
And you have to drive to the destination, and it was 2 guys on a truck.
Yeah.
And,
a lot of long hours, too, I remember.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the overtime. Everybody worked for the
sure.
overtime. And so I realized that that really probably wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just wasn't what I wanted to do, I guess, for the rest of my life. So then I decided I'd become a policeman.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a test and became a policeman and stayed there for... I was on the police department for about 2 years, and then they made me a detective, and I was a detective for about 5 years.
Right.
And that's how I got involved. That's when the drug thing was just starting to go around in the 60s.
Sure.
So.
Turned out to be a good situation.
Yeah. And then I went to all sorts of training through there. And then I met, working on the job, some federal agents, which at that time it was called Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. So I met those guys and worked with them and made friends with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of convinced me to go on the job. Well, I didn't have any formal education. Had my high school, got out of high school, went right in the Navy. So as I was a police officer, I worked nights and went to school full-time during the day. And got my degree. And then applied to them.
Mm-hmm.
And... then I eventually, after 3 years of waiting, I got hired.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, stayed with them 26 years.
Any interesting stories with them? Any
yeah.
busts or anything like that? Or?
Yeah, I could.
Give us one.
I could spend a lot of time here talking about that. Well, it's there I worked my way up through the ranks. And I when I retired, I was the assistant agent in charge of the New York office, which is the largest DA office.
Very impressive.
Yeah, it was. You know, we worked on a lot of things. I traveled all over. I traveled all over. Italy, over in Europe, you know, South America, Central America, Mexico, Canada, of course. And I went into management. I worked, well, I guess, towards the end of the career, my career, is when I went into management. I think I had like 12 years in or something like that before I went into management. And that was because my wife was pressing me to do it.
Okay.
And otherwise, I was just happy, yeah. You know, traveling all around and doing that type of work. And
what was the big narcotic that you were chasing at that time? What was the big
Well, it's cyclical. It went. You know, it depended on the administration and what was happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Our big thing when I first went on was heroin and huge marijuana things, like big shiploads of marijuana and hashish and stuff. But because I was in New York, our main focus was on Italian organized crime, because they controlled at that time all the heroin.
Okay.
So that's who we worked on. And then we had the other people that had these organizations, you know, in the city there. It was heroin. And then I remember when Carter was the president, he declared war on heroin in the city I was working in at that time, Newark. And he gave a press release, and we were all sitting in the office with our feet up on the desk because he wouldn't give us any gas to operate the cars. So we couldn't, just the things that happened, you know, stupid things that stick in your mind. And and then each you know, I got to meet a couple of presidents, you know, working there, and come to New York. I met the Bush, and both Bushes, and Reagan, due to my work.
Sure.
And yeah, I had a full career.
Good for you.
So I left there and I started my own business, and then did that for, well, I still actually have two companies here on the island.
And what do they do? The
one is an investigative consulting firm.
Okay.
And it's called the Glover Group.
Okay.
And we do work for, like, say, just little companies here on the island to Fortune 500, 100 companies.
Wow.
Large law firms. We do it all over the world, international. And the second company is called the Amelia Group.
Oh.
And we do pre-employment screening, you know, backgrounds for, sure, companies that want to hire people. And it's all web-based, and we're pretty proud of that. We built that all ourselves. So that's what I'm doing. I have no hobbies.
How long have you been on the island? How long have you been
here? Full-time, we've been here about 5.5 years.
Okay.
How we got here was, a friend of mine who was, an FBI agent, and we worked together on, you may not know, it was called the pizza case. It was Italians from both, Italy and the U.S., Sicilian people with the Bonanno crime family. We worked together on that, and we became friends, and, he also got transferred. You know, we got transferred all over the place.
Sure.
And they got transferred more frequently than we did. And he finally said to his wife, you know, we've been traveling, so you pick the place where you want to retire. So she picked this, and they built a house. So they invited us down. They moved in, and we came down 2 weeks after they got in.
Okay.
And that was our first time here. So that was about 10 or 11 years ago. And we kept on coming down a couple of times, and then we bought property, and we ultimately built a house on this, where we live in now.
Yeah.
And also we in the interim there, we bought a house over in Amelia Park. Great. We stayed, we have a little cottage over there, which we stayed in while we were building a house. So, and we finally moved down here. We were traveling back and forth, and when we first moved here, I still had my business up in Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C., so I would go up there on Tuesday mornings and come back on Thursdays. I did that for about a year. And then what I finally did is I had I had a big infrastructure up there, you know,
sure.
space. And so we just gave everybody laptops and said, you know, work from wherever you want. We're going to open this office up down in Amelia Island. So there's one or two of us here, and everybody's all over the place, and they just travel. When we need them, we just get together and go do it. So.
Now, do you like to watch movies? Do you like to travel? It's got to be something you do for fun. You're a busy guy.
Yeah, I I like the football. Okay. You know, I got season tickets to the Jags and had season tickets in New York for 30 years to the Giants. So my son's up there, and he does that, and I'm down here. So travel, I like to travel, although I haven't been doing too much lately. You know, as I said, you know, our company's sort of global.
Sure.
So we did a lot of work in Latin America, you know, five or six different countries. It took us about a year or two to get that project done. Done work over in Moscow and St. Petersburg and Russia, in England and China and the Philippines. And
everywhere.
So done a lot of traveling, and that was kind of fun. But my wife now has her own business, and as you know, Frank, and she can't get away anymore. You know, so.
Do you have a favorite spot that you visited with all those locations? Some place that surprised you when you got there?
I tell you what really surprised me when I said we did Latin America, we were in Argentina, we were in Buenos Aires, and we were in Peru, Lima, Peru, and we were in Brazil. We went to Rio and São Paulo, and São Paulo just blew me away. It was just like, they have, when we were there, 24 million people in São Paulo. They claim to have about 18. There's no way they can get the statistics and everything like that. You know, and here we think New York's a big city, and we're hovering around 8. And the crime there is just incredible.
That's what I understand.
Yeah. And so that kind of...
Is it beautiful there? Or is it pretty?
Yeah, it's nice. You know, Rio is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And I'd like to go back there, but it's kind of dangerous, you know, to bring your wife. You can't... You have to have a driver. You can't just walk around.
Right.
You know, you have to have somebody that knows... I'll give you an example. We arrived in Lima, Peru, and we were at the airport and we're looking for our driver. So you go outside, and they have like a road there, but nobody's, no cars on it. And there's all these guys that are dressed in brown jump pants and, you know, vests, bulletproof vests on and stuff, and they're carrying automatic weapons. So... And yellow shirts. So I thought that it was the army. And beyond them were hundreds of people just yelling and carrying on and stuff, you know. We find out that all those people are cab drivers or drivers and are trying to get anyone that's coming off the planes, right? We see our driver there. He's got our name up on a plaque.
Yeah.
So we're driving from there to the hotel, and it's sort of... You know, being American, we're looking at that and we're saying, my God, every place you look is the military with these automatic weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We come to find out that they're private security.
Well,
and they're hired by everybody. Like, if you go to a restaurant, they'll be on the streets. And they're hired by all the merchants. And that's to protect if you have a car or the people will come in the restaurant and just hold everybody up. So, you know, when you first get there, it attacks your senses.
Sure,
and then after a while, just like everything else, we as Americans, you know, you don't see them anymore. So you just, they're there, but you just don't see them.
Sure.
And these are, you know, you have executives over there. They drive around. They have bodyguards because there's all kidnappings going on there. And all these Latin American countries are like that.
Wow. Didn't realize it was that bad. I heard the crime was bad, but I didn't realize it was
that
bad.
Oh, yeah. I'll give you an example. We did a survey. New York City at the time was having, we were there about 2000, 2001. New York City, which we consider pretty violent, had 4 homicides per 100,000 population. Mm-hmm. And at the time, Sao Paulo had 83.
Wow.
So that just to give you a sense.
Yeah.
And look what's going on in Mexico today. Yeah. Same thing, Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a little off track here. But.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine. Before we conclude, is there anything else that you'd like to add to your interview that we maybe didn't touch upon? Anything that you want to reflect back to?
No. I think I'm... Otherwise, I'll be here talking. I think I'm about had it. I think I got it all down. Yeah.
It's been a great interview. We truly appreciate it. On behalf of the museum and the Library of Congress, Al, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Yeah.